Mr. Tyler, Real 4. We were talking about the invasion. You went to D plus 3, roundabouts D plus 3. What do you remember of the crossing and the ship you were on and what happened to you?
Well, we were on a sort of 10,000 tonner with all our vehicles, although only quite a small unit of them, because we'd been divided up into bits and different pieces of us were travelling with different ships. So we weren't all in a huge thing together. But we set off from the Pool of London, and it was quite dramatic, really, as we went through the Straits of Dover, because you could almost, well, in fact, I think from where we were, we could see the French coast. And our ships were going absolutely flat out as fast as they could. And we could hear some occasional gunfire. We didn't know what it was. And I remember being out on deck, writing my will in my army paybook. Nothing very complicated, didn't have much to leave. Something about a mother and a girlfriend. So I certainly did fill in my will in the army paybook in the middle of that journey. When we arrived off Normandy coast, it was the most quite extraordinary, dramatic sight. You'll see it in that book there. About 2,000 ships anchored off the coast, in fact, waiting to land. At this stage, of course, Mulberry Harbour had not been built, but it was under construction. And because we were in fairly large-sized ships, the method in our case was to drop the vehicles onto flatbed landing vehicles which didn't have any size. These were just sort of flat cargo. There's a technical name for them that I can't remember. But there was no problem because the weather was so good, and of course there was no opposition from the beaches, which were very calm.
You were in a queue for, I think, two nights and a day.
That's right.
And you were bombed.
Yes, so the first, and would you believe it, the last time I saw German aircraft in the whole of our invasion in the middle of the night, only about half a dozen of them came over. One of them was blown up just over our ship, probably by another ship was doing the firing, and the explosion lifted up the wooden hatch covers on one of our hatches and dropped a few bits of the wooden hatch covers down on my troops sleeping underneath. And I had my best corporal, Corporal Hicks, had a broken leg and was taken off. But it was crystal clear that there hadn't been any significant casualties. But it was very boring and very annoying just sitting on a boat waiting to be unloaded for a night and 2 days. When we eventually were unloaded, I was on a motorbike. And of course, the first thing that happened was I couldn't start the bloody thing as soon as we hit the shore. When we got going, we simply drove straight from the Aramanche beach to what had been a German barracks in Bayeux, which was only, 10 miles inland. So we immediately had our signal office going.
How did you establish your signal office? I mean, what was the signal office as far as you were concerned?
Well, it would be the centre where there would be wireless receiving sets. I think I doubt at that stage whether there'd be anything as formal as teleprinters. So it simply really took the form of largish rooms where our small units of sergeants and operators would be taking these messages down passing them back through to operational offices who would deal with them. A&Q, I think, is the great expression, isn't it? Administrative and quartermaster matters and supplies. And although it wasn't at one part of, as the battle got closer to Caen, in the night of the famous Battle of Caen, huge bombardment, the press corps had been sent over to watch it, and they came back to our signal office to send their copy back to England by WT, which means voice as distinct from Morse code. I was absolutely astounded when I first saw the Pluto terminal. The idea that we were getting our petrol by a pipeline under the channel just seemed exciting and very encouraging to us, because we had no idea in advance that it was going to be done like that, because security had been pretty tight. But we had enormous amounts of material, military stores dumped beside the road all around this quite small invasion area of about 10 miles towards Caen from the coast, and any significant German air force could have done untold damage to it. But Monty was as good as his word, and from my evidence it was absolutely right that the German air force had been shot out of the sky. And apart from this one attempt at bombing on about, I suppose it'd be about D plus 6, D plus 7 or something, that was the last I saw of the German Air Force. Although, of course, when we eventually got to Brussels, we started meeting the V2s, flying bombs. But at the time when the flying bombs were falling in London in large numbers, none were being dropped on the beachhead.
So how did the campaign progress? Because I realise you're not frontline troops, so it's just a routine operation, but what are your impressions of that campaign?
Well, disappointing, of course, in many ways. You heard that the Americans were going larger distances, and we were not very far away from the Americans. We didn't then know the whole strategic situation, that Monty was securing the centre of a wheeling operation while the Americans came round from the right and made a great gap, made a great bag in which hundreds of thousands of German troops were captured. But it was perfectly clear that the German opposition was pretty severe. On the other hand, I was astounded how much horse transport they'd been using. The number of dead horses and broken horse transport lying about was remarkable. So the German army wasn't only tanks and armoured vehicles and whatever. We were very much heartened to see these 1,000-bomber raids on Caen. You could see them come over from the coast behind us, circle in front of us over Caen, drop their bombs and complete the circle back to England. And although there was anti-aircraft fire, I could never see any of them shot down. So that made us pretty confident that things must have been going pretty well up there. We would only come across and see the evidence of what was happening as we began to advance beyond Caen and Falaise and famous places like Villers-Bocage, which had been captured and recaptured and bombed and shelled. That was almost completely demolished, and just showed how severe things had been up in the front line.
How did the French receive you as you moved forward, the French civilians? What was their attitude like?
saw very little of them, strangely enough, although it was surprising because I regarded myself as fluent in French, perfectly able to talk to any French people I came up against. But they were certainly glad to see us. They were certainly glad to see us, particularly, I suppose, by the time we reached them, they were no longer in the delicate position of being stuck between two fighting armies. And so by the time we got there, as distinct from the first day, second day, third day troops, everything had quietened down. And they were delighted to have got rid of the Germans. This is a strange thing, was that we saw not much of the French inhabitants, nor were we aware, of course, of the other army. Right, I hardly met any of it. The other, I refer to the 3rd Canadian Army, because the invasion force was the 3rd British Army, plus the 3rd Canadian Army were on the northerly edge of the flank, and I think those in the British sector didn't see a great deal of them. We did meet the Poles, who were desperately keen, happy to be on continental soil again fighting the Germans. But that was only small units we came across by accident. I also met an American corporal, not quite sure when, in about the first week of the invasion, practicing his golf with a golf club and a few balls. That was one of the more surprising meetings I had.
So what's the next thing you remember as you moved through France into Belgium?
Well, this was terribly dramatic. You had the feeling that, of course, the Americans were disappearing. They were all going off towards Paris, whereas we had to go north, cross the Seine, Rouen, through northern France to Brussels. And I guess the whole movement from Falaise to Brussels didn't take more than 3 weeks, whereas the first 10 miles had taken us 8 weeks. And somehow, it's like there was one whole road going north and northeast in which the whole of the British Army was on the move. And suddenly a tank lid would open and a chap would pop up who you knew or something. It was quite an extraordinary feeling that we were moving at a speed which we'd never expected. And we didn't really see much in the way of enemy opposition. So it was a very, very strange period, the post-Falaise bit.
Were you writing home any reports for either your northern constituency, you know, your constituency party, or for the newspapers at the time?
Well, it seems that I have some of the documents here, strangely enough. Yes, I was, because I was... The most amazing thing to me was how good the mail services were. I was a subscriber to Hansard, and I was getting parliamentary debates regularly coming through to me 2 or 3 days after the parliament had sat. It wasn't sort of coming weeks afterwards. It was almost like coming through the mail. And I collected these things and eventually brought them all back from Germany with me. In fact, I believe they're up in the attic now, and I haven't started to look for them. But I was writing letters to local, because I was also getting local newspapers from the Cheshire part of the world, because I was thinking in terms of trying to become a parliamentary candidate.
Why Cheshire? Was that because that's just a bit, that's a bit further, you were in more Stockport area, were you?
No, it's merely the Stockport was the name of the co-op.
Right, of course.
I lived in what is technically Timperley. My parents lived in Timperley, which is close to Sale. So it's most certainly Cheshire.
Right, sorry.
And I'm just looking at the letter of application which I wrote to, I think, the Altrincham Party, asking to be considered as a parliamentary candidate.
When was that written?
That would have been about October.
Of 44?
Well, maybe September. Maybe September 44. Although I certainly remember writing some of this before we left the common part of the world, before we got to Brussels.
Now you were
certainly produced a unit magazine for the troops, just as something to interest them, which we produced in the company office. And my leading article was a sort of layout of the House of Commons and how it was structured with the Speaker and the government and the opposition and all that sort of thing. So that was the sort of thing I was doing in my spare time.
Now, what had made you decide to stand for Parliament? I mean, you were very young for that. I mean, even now it would be considered young.
Yes, I was indeed. This is, we're talking 1944, I was 22. I have already reported how excited I was taking this Herbert Morrison meeting, attending Parliament and meetings in that 1 year that I'd been at Cambridge before going in the army. And the suggestion seemed to be that it would be reasonable to start trying to stand for Parliament, even though initially one would not expect to get a winnable seat. But it's all here is the whole story of how I put myself forward. I suppose this must have been typed eventually, but here I wrote it all out in my own hand. As references, I would like to quote Mr. Jim Griffiths MP and Mr. Ellis Smith MP. But the things I claim to have done are really extraordinary in a way.
Perhaps we'll take a photocopy of it at some point for the archive. So you were applying. Was it that the Labour Party was beginning to get its parliamentary candidates together at this point?
Yes, because I think the party was very concerned that they shouldn't be taken under. The feeling was that if the invasion was going pretty well, and there had been a lot of discussion as to when there should first be elections, should it be at the end of the European war, or should it wait for the end of the Japanese war? And although we didn't have a final answer to that, the party was very keen not to be left out when it came to getting candidates organised, and they were also keen that people in the forces should have a fair chance of being considered if they were within range of the UK. And so this process was going on all that time, and I applied originally to be considered for my local constituency, which was Altrincham and Sale. Originally I must have been in Brussels by the time I went back. Yes, because we got to Brussels on about the 16th of September. And I think I went back probably in the first fortnight of October. And I applied to my commanding officer for 2 days' leave for this purpose and been turned down. But I'd appealed from...
What had he said?
He said, Tyler, why should you be allowed to go home to get yourself a nice soft job for after the war? Unquote. He obviously didn't know anything about the political structure of the constituency I was applying to. But I could see his problem. But you then could appeal to a commanding general or something, and it seemed that the top brass were keen that those of us in the army shouldn't be excluded from consideration for candidature at the next election. So I came back and attended interview with other people.
What do you remember of the process by which the Labour Party selected its candidates at that time?
Well, people would get nominated either by wards, individual wards, which I think is what happened to me, or some cases by the Fabian Society. Everybody was scratching around with it, and then you would simply attend a meeting at which delegates would listen to speeches and ask questions, and then they'd vote. It all seems not a great deal changed, actually. And I was defeated at Altrincham, but a couple of months later came this vacancy at the proceedings in Knutsford. So I went back a second time, and on that occasion was successful.
Why do you think you were successful there and not at Altrincham?
I suppose it's, you know, a question of how far the character of the local party, whether they were terribly left-wing, or I don't think it wasn't so much a question of left-wing, it's more a question of perhaps was I too young to be taken seriously? You can well imagine party members might feel that I was a bit absurdly young, so I wasn't suffering from any great distress at being rejected in the first instance.
What sort of things did you refer to in your address or speech that you made to the delegates? Do you recall at all?
Well, I've got some address here entitled Socialism to Altrincham Divisional Labour Party. There's quite a lot of stuff here. But what of socialism? What of the idea and the ideas that inspired the Blatchford and Keir Hardies to do the spade work of the early campaigning that brought to birth the great labour movement of the day? The country has seen two very short minority socialist governments, but it is here. To say that socialism means the common ownership of the major resources and services, so that national resources can be put to the greatest use of the greatest number, is simply to put the whole thing in a nutshell, and it'd be wise to consider some of the more important implications of this policy. In industry, we have reached a stage where certain monopolies have grown up, which would keep prices high and generally control the well-being of its employees and the supply of goods to the public. From the point of view of the shareholders, the Labour policy, the whole policy is the socialised industry would be planned as much of the industry as in our when maximum efficiency is a necessity. Oh my God, there's several pages of this.
Perhaps, as I say, we take a photocopy of that at a later date.
Right.
And you were successful at Knutsford.
Right.
And what? I mean, you'd have to go back to your unit. But what sort of campaigning was the party doing before you? Would you appoint an agent at that point, or was it left in the hands of the constituency secretary?
We most certainly had. Obviously, there was an agent appointed for the election, a very good man who later became an agent in the London area. But initially, obviously at the time that we selected the candidate, I wouldn't imagine an agent had been appointed. It would be in the hands of the constituency secretary.
And was there any active campaigning going on to get your name about in Knutsford while you were away? Or
no, I don't think. I probably wrote one or two letters to a local paper. That was the sort of thing that one was doing in those days. Particularly replying sometimes to speeches made by local councillors and that kind of thing. As to what the local party was doing, I wouldn't really know. I would suspect very little indeed.
Now, you went back to your unit. How were you when you told them that you'd been picked? How did they react? Because, you know, I mean, the army, you were a Labour candidate. Was it? How did your fellow officers and men respond?
Well, I think by then everybody knew my political affiliations, and I mean, to some extent, I suppose they were, if you like, quite friendly about it. I certainly didn't meet any rejection. And I can't remember much of what was being said about it at the time. I just carried on regardless. What I was concerned about was how long was it going to take us to get towards Berlin and get the whole bloody thing finished.
And what about, do you remember the entry into Brussels at all?
Nothing really, except that it was terribly quick. I think the Guards Armoured got in about the 6th of September. I don't think we got there till about the 12th. And my main concern was to have found that the Germans had completely failed to destroy the cable chambers and the telephonic setup in Brussels, so that by the time we got there, we were able to take over the whole of the telephone system. Obviously, we weren't so much concerned with internal stuff within Brussels, but I think my first job was officer in charge of Brussels Trunks telephone exchange, which was the major links to other towns and other units and that sort of thing. And that was quite a big telephone exchange. We had a very shortly after we got there, they put on the first symphony concert after the war, which was a young Italian boy of 13 called Pierino Gamba, playing the Mendelssohn Piano Concerto. Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, I think. So obviously there was a lot of ordinary life going on in Brussels. And in the middle of a big town, weren't terribly conscious of what was going on around us. And we were in Brussels when the glider expedition to Arnhem came over the top. That was the most dramatic night, to see all these gliders going over. And we were desperately concerned about how they got on. And obviously what happened up there was a great disappointment to everybody, although we weren't necessarily put very fully in the picture. The most horrific, one is so distressed about as a signals man, is that the wireless never worked, so that the poor blokes who did land couldn't communicate either back to England or indeed into the people they were trying to liberate in Ireland. So that was one of the most horrific incidents of the whole war, although at the time we were sitting on the fringes of it, not knowing too much about the detail. And, of course, as I said, there were V1s being dropped on us. But you didn't, you know, you'd hear them like a beep, 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 but you'd see them. You'd not only hear them, you'd see them, and then suddenly there'd be a silence, and you knew it was about to drop, and it would go off. But it didn't happen awful, you know, you didn't feel they were going to drop on you particularly. It's just one of those strange thing. Oh yes, there goes a V1. I wonder what poor sods have caught it this time, so to speak.
What about V2s? Were they dropping at all?
I had 14 men killed in the summer in Antwerp by a V2. And they were a bit more horrific in the sense that you didn't know they were coming. You know, then you just boom, and that was it. So we were particularly, Arnhem was mixed up with this. We had to get north, obviously. We had to get, the further we could get north, the better chance we had of getting rid of the German launching platforms of the V1s and V2s up the coast in Holland. So the failure to get up there extended for a considerable period our exposure to V1s and